Did. Morning. We have a open rules hearing followed by an open conference. And first matter on the agenda is 1304 in the matter of the petition for amendment to rules relating to referees and lawyer regulation. And the presenter is Keith Saline. Mr. Saline, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. It's good to see you this morning and to be here.
Good morning.
Pleased to talk to you about the petition for modifying the rule on referees, the petition that has been, it's a proposal that was recommended by the study committee in its 2012 report. It's also been supported by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Board of Administrative Oversight. In this system, as in any system, it's rare that you can look at a proposal that would do all of these three things, result in something that's a better quality of product and process, do it in a more timely fashion, and cost less money. We have that opportunity as we look at this particular proposal today. And again, it's rare that you can do all of them without having to choose between those objectives. There are two things that I wanted to address to the court, and then, of course, I'll be happy to respond to your questions as best I can.
You know, Mr. Sleen, excuse
yes, Justice,
me, sir.
Sure.
Before you get into the substance of the petition, I wonder, we, at least as far as I know, most of the court so rarely gets an opportunity to speak with you. I know you meet with the Chief Justice on a regular basis, but I was very... my attention was drawn to your office's most recent report, and I think towards the middle of it was a list of referees that OLR calls upon. And I was surprised when I saw that former judge and reserve judge Tim Volke was no longer on that list. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that his appointments had really tapered off to zero. Do you have any insight that can help me understand either why he hasn't been appointed or why his name isn't on the list?
Justice, I don't believe I can offer
very
much.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I don't believe that I can offer very much. I can tell you that the referee appointments and the assignments are not influenced by OLR at all. They're made through the clerk and the court so that we are not having any influence over what assignments are made in cases or who is appointed as a referee.
Who makes that decision?
Under the rule, and there are rules that relate to the appointment of a referee in Chapter 22, and I think it's 22.11 or 22.13. But what will happen is the clerk will select some recommendations for referees, as I understand the process, and I am not involved in this.
The clerk will say that again.
I believe that the clerk will provide some names for the Chief Justice or in the Chief's absence.
I'm sorry. I missed that. Someone was talking to me.
Oh, that's okay. I'll speak a little slower, too. Maybe that will help. As I understand the process in the rule, the clerk would select some available names from the referee list and take into consideration the geographic proximity and the referee's availability, and then provide some names to the Chief Justice or, in the Chief's absence, the next senior justice for selection and appointment. And this would occur for proceedings that are filed in disciplinary cases and also for the review of consent reprimands under Rule 22.09.
So it's the Chief Justice who selects the referee for each case?
That's my understanding, Justice.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
And what rule are you referring to?
I would have to...
But it's our Supreme Court rules.
It's the Supreme Court rules. It's Chapter 22. It's either 22.11 or 22.13, and I think it's 11, but I'd want to look.
Your initial statement was correct, Mr. Saleen. Your second response to Justice Gableman is somewhat misleading. The Supreme Court has approved the list of referees. The actual referee selected in a particular case is assigned by the clerk's office, not by me, for that particular case.
Yeah. Thank you for that correction.
And so you were right when you said it the first time, but then in response to the second question, it was not incorrect, it's just misleading. And that is so that I do not select a particular judge. It's done at random, done by the clerk's office on the basis of geography and et cetera. So, and on the list, you can see, I think there's something in our materials about how often people are selected.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Thank you.
And I don't, when I sign, I don't even have the name of the lawyer. I sign that somebody should be appointed for that particular, for a lawyer. I think that's true. I think when I sign for approval of consensual, I might have the name of the referee, but he can be assigned for several different consents.
There have been some questions raised in some of the responses to the court about two issues. I wanted to speak to those briefly, and then, of course, respond to your questions. The first is that there has been some concern that the cost savings involved in this proposal was not clear. And I think that this is something that may be so obvious that we take it for granted a little bit. So with regard to the cost savings, I just wanted to offer an analogy that might help us think about this a little bit. You have four commissioners on your staff. If you were, instead of the four commissioners who are hired through a hiring process, who have qualifications that are directly related to the skills you want them to employ, who are available and required to take the assignments that you give, and then provide you a work product on a regular and ongoing basis. If you instead had 32 commissioners and not these four, who were from all over the state, who worked on a per diem, but were also able to decide whether or not to take a case, and who, of course, performed it less regularly than they do now, I think we would see that that would likely be something that would take more time for them to do and would probably be more inefficient than the system that you have now. It would result in increased costs because of the regard to the assignments, with regard to the regularity of their work, and the interaction that normally occurs in that context.
You know, talking about whether this change, if the court decides to do it, would be more economical, one concern I had is these, if we have four permanent folks to do the hearings for us, don't we end up with four employees? And if we do, we've got benefits we have to pay for them, just like we do all our employees. Have you looked at that question?
I have, and okay. I've spoken with Margaret Brady about the question.
Okay.
And the best information I have from her right now is that a reserve judge, for example, who is part of the retirement system, would be limited to 1,200 hours per year with regard to paying the retirement benefits or having any impact on the retirement benefits. I do not have the current information or the best information from her yet about what percentage of time a referee could work before benefits would become an entitlement. But I don't think that it would be less than 50% full time.
If you're going to have qualified people and the suggestions, I mean, I think all of the referees we've had in the past have done a pretty good job for the court. if they're not getting benefits from us, they got to get them from someplace. I mean, you aren't going to get people that are going to apply for this job and apply for it without benefits. So, you know, if you're looking at limiting their hours and they're looking at this being their employment, to me, those two things don't go together unless we give them benefits that we do to all our employees.
I understand, Justice. I think that there are enough referees who are currently working in the system who would not need benefits in order to buy in. Reserve judges would probably not need benefits to buy in. It's essentially a retirement kind of job, and they're expecting that kind of thing, and they would still have whatever benefits apply from their retirement. There are a lot of small firm and solo practitioners who could do this as a regular part-time work who I think would be interested in taking that on even without benefits.
It pays more than a public defender appointments, I think.
Yes, and some of the solo and small practitioners in particular have the benefits issue with their own office. They either handle it themselves or they're in a firm where they're able to do that.
But we have an obligation independent of that, right? We have an obligation to our employees independent of that. And we've chosen to give benefits after they work a given number of hours. I, too, don't know what the percentage is, but you talk certainly to the correct person to be able to inform us about it. But I think that's if we pay benefits, it would be a very significant amount of money.
If we do pay benefits, I agree. It would be a significant amount of money, and that would be a substantial consideration. If we get to that point, then it may not be economical. That's very clear. I think it would have to be done in a way where there would not be an expectation or a payment of benefits to the referee.
Well, the law expects us to comply with the law, which we do. So just because they may, you talk about there are a number of retired judges that might want to do this. Mm-hmm. Well, if we change the rule, we're not changing it for the number of retired judges that we currently have. We're changing it because we think it's a better way to take care of this responsibility that the court has to the public. So, I'm less persuaded by the fact of who are these folks that are out there now that might want the job. But you're suggesting we have four people. Now I'm hearing four people who are part-time, so we don't have to pay benefits. To me, that sounds like two people in regard to the time that would be necessary to handle all of these matters. That sounds pretty slim.
Right. I don't think that's going to be a concern practically. I think that when you look back at our experience over the last 2 years, that all the referee hours that were logged over the past 2 years averaged 30 hours per week in toto. So if you had four, you're talking about quarter time, and you wouldn't have to have four. But what I would suggest is that the contracts be structured such that we honor the law in a way that we are not obligated or expected to provide benefits.
Okay. I have one other question for you. I'll think about your thoughts about the fiscal impact. I have some concerns with setting up permanent referees that now we're going to be setting up a new kind of administrative court. And we already defer to the referees on their factual findings. Mm-hmm. And if you have permanent people, are we now going to be expected to defer to their legal conclusions and perhaps their recommendation of a sanction? And that would make our review much different than it is now.
The proposal does not envision any change to your standard of review.
I know the proposal does not, but in the history of Wisconsin and these kinds of entities that are set up to handle reviews for a particular part of government, that is the aura that they take on after a period of time.
The petitioners do not intend that would change.
Well, I guess what I'm wanting from you is, well, never mind. It's a concern I have, and perhaps it's not one that you need to speak to, but thank you.
Mr. Saleen, I wonder if you have a response to that portion of the commissioner's memorandum on page 2, where they point out as follows, the bottom, beginning of the last paragraph. Approximately 50 OLR complaints are now pending in the Supreme Court. A half dozen or so are recent filings where a referee has not yet been appointed. The remaining matters have been assigned to approximately 20 referees. If four referees were assigned to handle most or all pending cases, that would mean each of them would be responsible for 10 active files. That would seem to equate to a full-time or nearly full-time workload per referee, at least for substantial stretches of time. Do you agree with that observation or disagree, and what is your response?
I disagree with the observation. Over the last 2 years, all the referee hours that have been logged in on all of the cases would average 30 hours a week. So it would not be, it would equate to a quarter time position, would handle all the work that all the referees have billed over the last 2 years.
I guess I didn't follow the math there. 30 hours a week sounds pretty close to 40.
But that's for all the work in the entire system. It would be one three-quarter position if one person did it. If you hired one, they would work three-quarter time over the last 2 years, and that would be all the work. All the
four referees would work together 30 hours, so each would work roughly eight.
It would be seven and a half, eight.
Including travel time and all of the logistical things that would require them to get from here to the different parts of the state.
Would not include travel time, so it would be, travel time would be in addition to that.
I wonder, do we have in our record, do we have in the filing somewhere the number of hours that the referees have logged in, say, in year 2012?
I looked over the last two fiscal years, Justice, and it was 3,100 hours total.
Did you happen to provide a copy of that to the court?
That should be in my memorandum mm-hmm. to the court.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, when I want to just continue that line of questioning or comments. When I first read this, I made the assumption that was underlying Justice Gableman's opinion, comment, that is, that you'd have four people working, each one working almost full time. It just seemed to me an enormous caseload, and that's what we were going to have. So when I then read the response, that it was no. And so I wasn't surprised when I read the commissioner's comment that it would be each referee almost full time, because that's the appearance by the number of cases. And the court, I had asked for some statistics on this. The court in, if I can find it, 2000, last couple of years, have put out roughly 40, have dealt with roughly 40 OLR pieces of activity. I'm sorry, I can't find it. I have to get that. And then I asked for similar data from the year 2003-04 and comparison on that. I thought there'd be an enormous difference in the number of matters that had come to the court. And there might be some difference between whether it's a per curiam or an order or whether it's a stipulation or not. But in total numbers, it wasn't that different, which surprised me. I don't know if your figures show roughly the same.
I don't look at that particular data, but I do look at the number of lawyers who are publicly disciplined from year to year, which is in the annual report. There's not a significant difference.
Yeah. Well, and after all, we handle each of them, whether it's mm-hmm. by one form or other.
Right.
And when I read your request, I thought to myself, if four are good, one is even better. So if you have less than a full-time job, then why not have one referee? Then you get uniformity as to recommendation for discipline. You get uniformity in examining the nature of the alleged offense. you get experience, et cetera. And I don't know, you could have a three-quarter time job or even a full-time job, and there are other things that could be done relating to discipline, relating to ethics, et cetera. And that led me to look at what other states do. And as you know, Mr. Saleen, this court changed the lawyer discipline system about 13, 14 years ago. And at that time, we, in open conference, explored what kind of system should we adopt. And the American Bar Association brought in people, and we had people from Colorado and other states come in and talk with us. And ultimately, we adopted what I have referred to in my mind as the Colorado Light system. In other words, it's Colorado with modifications. And one of the modifications we took was your system that we've adopted of the telephone calls and the fast-track grievance that are handled. And from your reports, I find that that seems to have worked very well.
Yes, indeed.
Then we modified Colorado there, too, but we modified Colorado. We kept the district committees, although they do not do that much work. They do some. Have a system of several referees. We have a system whereby we hire, your office hires lawyers to represent OLR. Some of the work you do yourself with lawyers, but some are consulted out. We have a system that there's costs are assessed against the lawyer if the lawyer is found to have violated the code. And that's become a major issue in the court about how much cost should be assessed. And so in looking at this referee and looking whether it is, if four is better than 32, and then isn't one better than four, I explored what's happening around the country with my fellow chief justices at their summer meeting. And found that Colorado does not have a backlog. They say they don't. I mean, I didn't look at their figures.
Their data is good.
Pardon me?
Their data is good.
I found that the Colorado system has been adopted in Arizona. It's fairly new, so at least as in its new state, it seems to be working. Oregon is looking at adopting Colorado, and I didn't get a chance to talk with Florida, but Florida seems to have an interesting way of proceeding. And some of the things I found were that Colorado and Arizona and use what I call a vertical system. That when a matter is investigated, a lawyer on the staff is appointed, and the lawyer works with the investigator, so they do their investigation together, and it's keyed in towards the ultimate complaint and evidence, which may help in, or may not, in discovery by the OLR. We do what I call a horizontal. I'm sure advantages to both. But the thing that concerns me is we've never gotten rid of a substantial backlog. We dropped substantially for a while, but still had a backlog. We're now at about 169 lawyers with I don't know how many allegations or complaints. they've been in investigation for over a year.
Right.
And I do not view that the referee system is a cause of the delay here, because there is delay, and there's delay everywhere in the system. But when we have the referee, and then we have another pending matter about enforcement, and then we have another matter that's going to be pending on whether we should reveal the names of the lawyers, some lawyers that are in investigation. And why would you want to reveal them? Because it takes so long while they're in investigation. All that leads me to say, after 13 or 14 years, I think that we ought to look at the system. I would like to look at the system again in terms of Colorado and Arizona, maybe Florida and Oregon, and to see where we can cut down on the delay, especially at the front end in the investigation. But there's delay elsewhere in the system. Remember, you did a chart that indicated it, and no one's free from delay, including this court, in terms of getting out its matters. So what do you think about that?
No, I think that would be something that would be worth looking at. I would want to tell the court a couple things about that. First of all, the delays in the processing times are things that have concerned me from very shortly after my arrival here in 2000. And one of the eye-openers when I came here was to see the backlog that existed. It was the question I should have asked during my interview. And it was a little bit, it was quite heart-sinking to see that. So we've worked hard on it. We've had some challenges, and we've made some progress from time to time. And in recent years, you know that the economy's been hard, and during the same time period, the caseload had advanced quite significantly. Second thing I would want you to know, just to make sure that there's not a misunderstanding. When you look back over the last 9 years, the average processing times for formal investigations have been less than the average processing times for litigation once the complaint is filed in each of the last 9 years. Sometimes it's very close. More frequently, it's quite dramatic, and the trend is not good. So there are areas all over. I'm concerned about all of that. I know I have a responsibility with regard to how things are processed in our office. The third thing I would like you to be aware of is that now, there's been significant effort placed into finding ways to be more efficient in our process. And as I look at many of those ways, including things like the vertical system or other ways we might reorganize our work, it's one of those things where I can't come to you with something that is better, faster, and cheaper. So I think it merits some study to look at what some other states do to see where we might get some ideas and we might learn how to do things a little bit better.
I'd like to follow up on that. You mentioned different efficiencies and how can we do things better. This seems as good a place as any for a launching point. A question that I've would have liked to have asked you for some time and have not had the opportunity. What is your view of OLR's discretion when it comes to prosecuting a case once a referee, for example, recommends dismissal? Do you believe that you're the director, so what you believe really matters. Do you believe that the office has discretion to dismiss the case, or do you believe that the office has a duty to see it to its bitter end, which is usually an oral argument here or written submissions?
I think you're asking me about the decision to appeal, and I think you're also asking me about what happens after the PRC finds cause to proceed. Is that
sure?
Sure. Okay.
That'd be great.
The latter first. When the PRC finds cause to proceed, we, OLR at that point, feels a moral obligation to proceed. The rule provides me, in response to the PRC findings, three options that do not include dismissal. And it's very interesting when you look at 2208.
Do you think that would be helpful to you?
It might be helpful. I don't feel absolutely bound by it. You will see in cases that come before you.
But do you think it would be helpful if the option of dismissal were added?
It would, yes, no doubt. PRC might not agree with that.
Of course not. They're making the recommendation to proceed.
That's right. We, all our views, the PRC is the charging authority. We certainly cannot charge without their finding and decision. Once they've made it, our options are limited to filing a complaint, diverting it, or seeking a consent public or private reprimand.
There are three distinct opportunities. One, you get a complaint.
Chief Justice, what I'm interested in is the director's belief of what his role and responsibilities are. And I appreciate your, as always, willingness to help. But in order to help me understand the office's practices better, I would respectfully request that Mr. Saleen be allowed to complete his answer.
You may complete it, but there aren't. Is one is a decision to appeal after a referee. One is after the PRC has acted. There's another stage where you may have discretion, and that is to bring it to the PRC.
Yes.
So your view is what has been articulated by the Chief Justice.
Pardon me?
His question was to Mr. Saleen.
I know, but
he agreed with what you said.
So your... I guess none of this has been helpful to determining what your understanding of your discretion is. So please continue, if you wouldn't mind, responding to my question.
I will.
Thank you.
And with regard to the PRC's decision, I think I've completed my response. Do you need any more information about that? The Chief Justice is correct that I do make a decision to present a matter to the PRC. At the end of an investigation, still in the confidential stage, at the end of the investigation, I have options at that point, and dismissal is one of those options. Seeking a diversion agreement or a consensual private or public reprimand is another option, and we're in Rule 2205.
How does that interplay with the no plea bargaining rule?
That's a very good question and a very difficult one for me to give you an answer about.
How do you think it should work?
I'd be happy to explain that, yes.
How do you think it should work? That would give you the ability to exercise discretion, the ability to provide uniform justice to the lawyers who are brought into the process. How do you think it should work?
I think it should work in a form that would be, first of all, I'm comfortable with the guidance I have from the court. I'm comfortable with whatever that would be. And I'm comfortable with where we are now because that's how I understand the guidance from the court.
Yeah.
I spent several years as a prosecutor in the military system, and I think a system similar to that would be good. It provides the lawyer doesn't make that decision. The commander does. There's a review of it in that system. If we were to proceed in that direction, I would be comfortable with authority to plea bargain, provided that there was a mechanism for review.
Could that review come from this court?
I would think it would not need to in many circumstances.
We review stipulations all the time.
In some cases, I think it would be necessary and appropriate. In many cases, it would not be necessary. It could be done by the preliminary review committee. It could be done by a referee. And frankly, I have not thought about that, and I did not anticipate being asked that today.
But the authority to plea bargain would be helpful to you.
Yes.
Okay. Please continue. Once the referee...
The referee's decision is made.
Yes.
When the referee's decision is made, then I get recommendations from our counsel regarding whether to appeal. And when we do that, we take in mind not only the referee's decision, which we will read, but we also take a look at the standard of review.
When you say recommendation from counsel, are you using that in the singular or the plural? Is there one counsel assigned to each case, or does everyone sit around the table and give their thoughts?
It would be the counsel who tried the case and their supervisor, our litigation counsel at OLR.
Who's that?
Mr. Bill Weigel.
That was Mr.
Weigel. Mr. Bill Weigel.
Okay, so you have that meeting. So there are three of you.
It's not necessarily a meeting, but the three of us do communicate. I will get a recommendation. It may be communicated in a meeting, or it might be something that Bill relays to me from his discussion with counsel. And sometimes we sit. Sometimes I just listen, and I take some time to look at it myself and then decide. It depends on the case.
And then you make the call.
I make the call.
Right. What are the factors that you use when you make that decision?
I'm looking to see whether there is, in most cases, I'm looking to see whether there is a reasonable belief that the court would grant relief based on their standard of review. You'll find that it has happened, but you'll find it very rare where we have brought an appeal to dispute the referee's perception of a witness or to contest a factual finding, although we have done that in some cases. And I've done that in a case you decided not too long ago. And there are reasons why I felt it was appropriate to do that. I'm not certainly surprised or troubled in any way by the court's opinion on it, but it was a case where I thought the court needed to be aware of certain facts in the record before it made a decision. I wasn't presuming it would go in our direction, but I was concerned the court would review the case and not be aware of these facts. And so I appealed it for that very reason. And it preserved your prerogative.
So the reasonable belief court would grant relief. Anything else?
No.
No. You. Okay.
No.
I ask a follow-up question, Mr. Saleem. You bring cases to the Preliminary Review Committee. My recollection is when the court met with the Preliminary Review Committee and the Board of Administrative Oversight, I think that was the meeting, percentage of approvals of your recommendation by the PRC are fairly high, are they not?
They are.
How high?
98% by count.
Aye.
By count, 98%.
98%. Okay. Could I ask a couple of other questions here? First of all, I think it would be very useful for you to take those three objectives that you outlined right at the beginning. Better quality, more timely, cost less money. And make like a closing argument on each point here. Give it to us.
Sure. In my experience, in the experience of Colorado, Arizona, and my experience and your experience in the systems and the people that you have managed, you will see, I believe, and agree, that when you have individuals whose qualifications are focused on their responsibilities, and so we're talking about reserve judges and trial lawyers, as Attorney Johnson recommended, with which I agree, and when you have them do that work on a regular basis, under your regular supervision, you're going to improve the quality of the work. It's going to save you, as a court reviewing the cases, your commissioners who are working on the cases, time and effort. When you get the commitment from these individuals to actually take cases through the contract, it's going to save you time making the appointment. It's going to save time because they are going to become, as time goes on, more efficient in their work. I was a professor. The first year teaching was a lot of work because I was learning courses, designing courses, and teaching courses. Next year, it was a lot easier. I could do a lot more. And in the experiences I've had from job to job where they would last 2 or 3 years and I would move to a new job, every once in a while there's always a learning curve. And once you learned it, you became more efficient. If you, as a referee, or anyone as a referee, became 5% more efficient, 10% more efficient at a per diem rate, you would cover 3, 4, 5, 10 times the cost of travel that would occur during the course of a year, easily by doing that. It would save costs just in terms of the referees per diem, not to mention OLR's counsel's $70 rate, that exorbitantly high rate we pay. It doesn't cover their overhead. It saves the respondents or the respondent's attorney time, which is not accounted for in this petition. And you will improve the timeliness. Arizona, when they went to their presiding disciplinary judge program in 2010, during the first year, their processing times were cut in half. The next year, they were cut in half again. And even with contested cases, it went slower. But in 2 years, it was cut in half. And they're all very happy.
Counselor, you just used a phrase when Arizona went to their disciplinary judge. Was that a system similar to what you're recommending to us?
It is not the same. And one of the reasons it is not the same is that that person is an employee full-time, and there are benefits, and there are some office overhead expenses, particularly with Colorado. I know the numbers, but I don't know them with Arizona. And so one of the reasons that I'm recommending this instead of that is because it allows us to achieve some good benefits and manage the cost, so we do not have to increase costs.
What drew my attention to your responses to Justice Prosser was the use of the term disciplinary judge.
Yes.
Because I have to tell you, I'm not anxious to set up another level of court system within our court system. And that is one of my concerns about having permanent referees. And I talked to you a little bit about it. It isn't anything that I read about in the materials that I've been presented, but it just seems to me it's a possibility, and your use of that term brought back that possibility. And I guess I'm wondering, are they sworn in as a judge? How did you end up having that term? I assume it's the referee you're talking about when you say disciplinary judge, right?
In the Colorado and the Arizona systems, it is. I used it because that's the title of the person
sure.
in that state.
That's right. And I see my concern is I can see that happening here without the title. When I started practice, administrative law judges were called hearing examiners, and they weren't judges at all. But it has morphed over the period of time since 1980 when I first got out of law school and began to appear before these tribunals into something quite different. And I have concerns that as we start a process that you're recommending, are we setting up that kind of progression because we haven't talked about that being a possibility?
The presiding disciplinary judge model has not been something that was discussed with the bar or the board of administrative oversight in formulating this petition.
No, I understand that.
I do understand the trend you're
concerned about. I'm concerned about the inadvertent establishment of a new court system within Wisconsin because we haven't talked about it and addressed it. It's the system they're using when you say a disciplinary judge. Okay, so you've got an administrative system within their court system. I don't know what Arizona does. I haven't read the materials from Arizona, so I don't know that. I only voice to you my concern about doing something inadvertently that I personally am opposed to. Now, the court may not feel the way I do at all. This concern was not in any of the materials. It's just something that came to me as I reviewed everything last night. Is this what we're starting out? Are we starting out down this path without realizing that's where we're going? And I guess just my experience with how administrative law judges came into being in Wisconsin was a similar path, frankly.
All right.
The court may feel totally different than I do. I haven't talked to my colleagues about this either. I just wondered about it, but that is what they are called within the Arizona system, and they are judges.
Would it be different if they called them Colorado discipline referee?
I'm sorry, Chief, I did not hear
that. Could they be called Colorado discipline referee?
Chief, his office is Office of the Presiding Disciplinary Judge. It is his title.
That's his title, but
yes.
Could you call him a discipline referee?
If
Colorado wanted to?
They certainly could.
You know, Mr.
Adjudicator.
See, my concern is really not. You used the term, and it brought back to mind a process that I am opposed to. And that's the only reason I bring it up again, because that is the model they went to. And maybe my colleagues would like to go to that model. I don't know, but I do want to put it on the table and let people talk about it, because I think it's, in some ways, underneath this petition, though you weren't moving in that direction. You know how things happen inadvertently. I mean, you take one step down the path, and then you take two, and then you take three, and pretty soon you're a long ways down the road. So I just wanted to talk about it a little bit. Thank you.
Is your pencil up because you want to talk, Justice Presser?
Yeah. Mr. Okay. Saleen.
All right.
I thought I heard you say that assigned counsel was paid at $70 an hour?
Yes.
Okay. Why would the referees be paid $15 less than that?
I don't know. I mean, they're paid at the reserve rate for – they're paid at the per diem rate for a reserve judge. And that's how it has been established. I don't have a concern if it was equivalent or greater, other than a budgetary concern, obviously. But, I mean, it would seem – seems a little bit upside down to me.
So if that concern were addressed – then perhaps the cost savings would be quite so great. Is that right?
That would be a separate issue. And to be honest with you, if you would then have to compare the two proposals at the new rate, because the cost for referees would be increased under both the current way we do it and the new way we do it. There would still be a relative savings.
Now, you used a phrase that costs would not include travel time. Is that right?
No, I'm sorry if I misspoke. That you could have cost savings in the efficiency of the referee's work. The referee would save time doing the work per case. Would be able to do work, the same amount of work, quality of work, in less time based upon the regularity and the learning that they do in that normal process that anyone would do in a new position. And that the savings from the per diem would more than handle a significant increase in the cost. It would be much more than, you know, 3 to 5 times our current costs for travel. You can see in the memo I gave you the information that the costs for travel are about 3% of the referees' billings in our system over the last year.
What do we pay a referee for travel?
They're paid the standard mileage rate. They get the standard state guidelines for meals, and they stay at the contract rate, $69 for an overnight stay if they need it.
But for example, let's suppose Judge Murphy were to take a case in Green Bay.
Okay.
It's a good 3 hours up there, I think. And good 3 hours back.
Okay.
Is he paid for the travel time?
I'd have to look to see. I don't know that he's paid per diem for his travel time. I do know that he's paid mileage. And I'm not 100%
sure.
But now,
if a public defender is paid something for travel time.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Isn't that true?
Roughly half.
I don't know.
It's a different rate than the courtroom rate.
Well, now, let me see here. You talked about 3,100 hours over a two-year period. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So over a one-year period, that's about 1,550 hours. And if I divided that by four, if my math is correct, that's 387 hours.
Okay.
And I think the statistics show that the average case takes 44 hours.
Right.
Now, 44 into 387 gives you something between 8 and 9 cases.
Right.
Is that right?
I believe the math is correct.
Okay. But that isn't going to include the travel time.
No, it does not.
Does that include the time for actually typing reports?
Yes.
It does.
It does.
So the judges, the referees are paid for typing?
They are paid for drafting the report, and they will bill hours for drafting the report. I know one referee who will draft it and either dictate it or provide it in form for an assistant to actually type up. Most of our referees get on the computer like I do, and I don't have a dedicated secretary. I type my letters, and I prepare the drafts of things that I do and put them in final form and have somebody proofread them. I do it on my computer, and My drafting is my writing, essentially, and that's how many of the referees work.
Mr. Saleem, is there a geographic – you must have an idea of where most of these cases come from.
Yes.
There – how does it sort of pan out across the state? We live in a big state. We're not from Rhode Island. It takes, you know, 72 counties, and it takes a long time to get to Superior. You know, I mean, where do these cases generally come from?
You'll find that about a quarter of them are in that Milwaukee area right now, and then there's a smaller percentage that's roughly around, you know, the Madison. There's a good percentage in the Fox Valley. So I would say between what I would call the core area of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Madison, and the Fox Valley up to Green Bay, you've probably got more than a majority of the cases.
That's where most of the lawyers are, too.
Most of the lawyers are who are.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Where do you anticipate the four referees would come from? I know you say there should be a committee and there's one justice and some other people that would be on it.
Yes.
But where do you think they should be from?
I think
that area?
I'd be happy to answer that. I think it does not have to be immediately four. But I think there should be one from Milwaukee. And if there is a second, it should be either in Madison or somewhere in the Fox Valley.
Okay. And
there should be one in the northwest part of the state.
Okay. I commend you for trying to think of more efficient ways to do things. And I try to do the same thing. It doesn't always work, but try. Anyway, I'm just trying to sort this out, how it really works. So if you have four people, let's mm-hmm. just say you do, is there a right to substitute for both sides?
I think that there should be. It would not jeopardize the system. I think that you might want to modify it in one of a number of ways. First and foremost, OLR would say it should be the same for the respondent and OLR. Mr. Dietrich has given you some very good reasons why the respondent may want to substitute by right. And in OLR situation, it would not generally relate to the office, very rarely. But we also have retained counsel, we have grievance, we have witnesses, where the same kinds of considerations might arise, and a substitution by right might be very appropriate. So we would think whatever the court would decide, it should be the same for both parties. That being said, if you operate with the system as is, the substitution of one or more permanent referees would have the effect under the current draft of then going to another permanent referee outside the area or to an auxiliary panel referee. Right now, in 40% of the court's cases right now, a referee outside the geographical area is appointed. And Mr. Volke, in his memorandum to you, provided some of the rationale for why that happens. And it happens quite frequently, where there's just a relationship, there's just a desire for the referee not to be involved in that case. They decline to do that. So we're going to have some of that anyway. So that's one option. Option two would be to say we'll change the last part of the rule to say when there is a substitution for cause, then an auxiliary panel referee can be appointed, and then you can look to that same geographical area. That's another way to do it. So instead of the rule saying auxiliary members are appointed only when no permanent members are available, it could read auxiliary members may be appointed when no permanent members are available or a permanent member or permanent referee is subject of a substitution request. So that would allow you to maintain the geographical idea. There is a third option, if you wish.
Yeah, sure.
And that would be to allow the substitution by right for both parties to exist only with regard to auxiliary referees and not with regard to the permanent panel. And there would be a good rationale for doing that, and I'm not going to speak for Mr. Dietrich. I think if it were the same for both parties, I think OLR could certainly accept that.
When I heard you answer, Justice Prosser, I'm sorry, do you want to go ahead or can I?
Please, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Justice Siegel.
I just have a couple of follow-up questions. You think the quality will increase? And I wanted to talk about that a little more. I remember when we were in Washington County, we were looking at, gosh, should we try to contract with lawyers for GAL appointments? Should we try to, is there a more efficient way to do court appointment of counsel, those things? So, you know, I've been down this road a little bit on that score. And
sometimes that makes sense, sometimes it doesn't. So that's what I'm trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. But if you think quality will improve, what's wrong with the quality of the list of people we have? Are you getting poor reports? And if you are, why don't we remove those people from the list?
This is not a complaint about the quality of any referee. And it is not a petition, if you adopt it, that requires anyone from that list to be removed. It doesn't. We do see varying quality in the reports of referees. Some are exquisitely good. Others are not so good. Some are much more difficult for the court to review because they are just not complete.
Okay. I guess my point is if I were putting together a list of people that I wanted to appoint to cases, I'd want to make sure they're competent and they do a good job. So I wouldn't want people on the list who are substandard. Why would someone who doesn't do a good job stay on the list? I don't get that. Or is it just that those people don't get appointments? Is there discretion in that regard? Or how does that work? Because I wouldn't appoint someone who didn't do a good job to defend somebody. Yeah. I just wouldn't do it.
Thank you.
Or to prosecute. Well,
Lawyer doesn't have any influence over that. I mean, we don't appoint referees. We're not the...
Yeah, I understand that. But how would you tweak that so that their good people get appointed?
The commissioners, I think it was, if I'm correct, suggested that maybe one of the solutions would be to have a conversation with just the referees where they don't think that the reports are up to that quality or the court can do that. The court would have discretion not to make the assignments or to not include them in their panel.
The clerk of courts just randomly goes off the list and it's bing, 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 bing. This person gets an assignment. Then you go back up to the top and you assign the exact same people over and over again. And they are all equal. They all get the same amount, basically.
The list of experience of the assignments is there for you. The clerk would have information about that. I can't give you good information. I'm just not involved in that process.
Okay.
But I do share your concern.
I mean, that's the answer. If you're not getting quality work, don't have these people on the list.
That's something that could be done, right?
Okay. And then more efficient in work. I understand the idea of being a teacher and you have your game plan and one year you teach and then the next year you teach kind of the same thing. You might fine-tune it, but mm-hmm. It's the same thing over and over. As a judge, every case deserves its due. So, you know, as a referee, you're sitting and I would hope that you'd give everyone a fair shake and take your time to do it right once. So... How I don't see this as the same as a teacher where your lesson plan is done and you do the same lesson plan the next year. Every case is different. Every hearing is different. The witnesses are different. The conclusions you reach are different. And if you're doing your job right, it doesn't mean that your 10th case is going to take 5 hours, whereas your first case took 15 hours. To me, if you're doing it right, you give every case their due regardless of whether it's the 10th case or the first case you've done.
I agree. It's not the same as teaching. I think there are still some skills and efficiencies that are obtained in the position of a referee with which you might identify because the familiarity with the process improves. The familiarity with the application of the rules of civil procedure and the rules of evidence improves with experience. And the ability to write reports will improve and become more timely with experience. Every case is going to be different, and that doesn't mean my first report is going to take me 10 hours longer than my second report because the first report might be a very minor case, one count, and the evidence is very clear. It could even be a stipulation. And the next one could be, you know, extremely difficult case with mixed findings and a lot of witnesses. So that's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that familiarity with the process and the ability to more timely go through that writing process, having, you know, an idea of how I've done it before, what I'm looking for, I gain that experience and insight that helps me to think more efficiently and to express myself more efficiently. I have not served in your position, but I would think that the first year of writing opinions was probably took a little more time than the second, third, or the 10th year of writing opinions, I would think. But I know that you give due diligence to every case, which you must.
Well, there are things that come easier after you've done them, like standard of review.
Yes.
But to the extent that they're different, it takes some time.
You know, Mr. Saleen, I would like to echo.
Can I just finish?
Oh, I thought you
one
were
more
done
question. I was just going through your answer to Justice Prosser, because as you did that, I had a couple of questions, and it went down the line, and I didn't. The third one is, you think it'll cost less money.
Right.
To who?
It will cost less OLR dollars in the budget that we have in terms of payments to referees, because we think by doing work more efficiently, it will save some of their per diem.
Are any of those costs recovered from the respondent
yes,
in a case?
Yes, they are.
So are most of them not recovered? Is that why there's going to be a big difference here?
I would say most are recovered. I don't have I haven't looked at the data recently on it. It's been a long time. It was about 67 cents on a dollar in 2003, 2004.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, again, I'm looking back at trial court judge. If you appoint someone counsel and the county initially pays, but the county recoups what it paid,
right,
it doesn't really end up being a big cost savings to have a different payment, right?
Well, that's true.
So I'm trying to figure out where the cost
right,
savings
it would apply
is.
To both this proposal and the current way we do it. When you can put them side by side, you're still better off under this, because the increase in travel costs would have the same effect. There would be actually a less effect of the increase of travel costs, proportionally so, because of collections, and it would be offset by that. So there would be a cost savings.
Okay, I didn't track with you there. If you pay a referee $1,000
right.
and you collect $1,000 from the respondent for the referee,
right.
how does that save you money?
It's the difference between what is spent and what is collected. But that number back many years ago when I looked at it, there was a gap of about 33 cents. So we didn't collect 33 cents. So there's a savings in that total amount, which means 33% of it is also less. So we do save costs as it relates to what is not collected.
Okay. So, all right. Okay. Thank you.
Welcome.
Justice Gableman, did you want to say something?
Well, I was going to wait. And, Mr. Salina, I suppose one of the reasons I'd been eager is I'm used to seeing different colored lights on that little box in front of you, and I turn and I look and I see why there are no lights. So how convenient for both of us.
Convenient indeed.
I'm not sure you meant that.
I come in peace. And I want to echo, to underscore that, I want to echo Justice Eagler's first comment to you, which is I appreciate the fact that you are looking for efficiencies, and you are looking for ways to make the system perhaps a little more timely without sacrificing any of the quality of the due process rights of any of the parties involved.
Thank you.
And I think one of the reasons, and I'll only speak for myself, I think one of the reasons that I'm so eager to ask you questions is I don't really have, this is the first opportunity I think I've ever had to ask you any questions about how your office functions or how you view the role and responsibility. Would you be open to any member of the court setting up a meeting with you and some of your staff so that if a member of this court was interested in your views and sort of background and context of how things work, would you be willing to do that?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Mr. Salina.
And I also want to go through, Justice Prosser did some math for us, and I have no quarrel with the numerical accuracy of it, but I looked at it a slightly different way, keeping in mind the new efficiency that we'd be looking at if there were four referees. According to the memo that you sent us, and Justice Prosser quoted, it was actually more answers to questions from September 17. Question, how much time on average does a referee invest in a disciplinary case? Answer, for disciplinary cases referees completed in fiscal year 2013, the average time spent was approximately 44 hours per case. So if we have four people working on those cases rather than the greater number we have now, we could take a one-year approach and say, gee, these cases ought to be addressed in a year. And if we did that, we would take 44 hours per case multiplied by the 50 pending cases, and we would get 2,200 hours, which is roughly the, I think it's almost exactly the equivalent of a 40-hour work week, of the typical worker's 40-hour work week for a full-time job, 2,200 hours, plus or minus. If we divide that by four, we obviously get 550 hours, which would be the equivalent of a one-quarter time job, as opposed to anything less. So these four referees, especially if greater efficiency is our goal, would be approaching these to, I would think that for the vast majority, 1 year ought to be an ample target. I might be wrong because I don't know enough about how your office operates. But it seems like we're creating, one way of looking at it anyway, with the information that's available to me, is that we'd be creating four quarter-time jobs plus the travel time, which if it's many people take a day for their travel, or even a half day. So that adds up. And I wonder if we've done the math to see how that plays out when we're looking at all of the time. And I'm not, you can work with these numbers, and there are so many different variables.
Sure.
And that's one of the challenges. There are so many different variables. But I'm not sure that I have enough information to determine that this will actually cut down on expenditure. And if, as you say, concern over quality is not what is driving this, you were very diplomatic in indicating there are variances, as there are in any human endeavor. But I'm not sure yet that we have what more could we have? What do you think, or what do we have that most efficiently sums up the argument that this proposal would save money?
It was, I don't know how I could say it any differently. I think the best analogy is to think of, instead of having four commissioners, you got 32 around the state and paying the per diem. I think it's easy to see the timeliness savings. The cost savings is a little bit more difficult to see, but it is a direct relationship from saved time per case, is what it is.
And final question. I noted a letter from attorney James Moore, Jr., a trial lawyer of 41 years experience, and he took issue with several of the points of the petition, and this runs to efficiency. And it's his letter dated September 17, 2013, and I'm looking at the third to final paragraph on the second page, where he says, several years ago, I presided over a disciplinary hearing, which in my judgment could have been resolved in 1 or 2 days of testimony if OLR had properly focused on the only issue that was in dispute. Instead, the case went on interminably. It took OLR approximately 11 trial days to present its case. Since trial had originally been estimated to last 2 or 3 days, we had to continually find additional trial days, which meant that the entire hearing process lasted approximately 1.5 months in order to accommodate all of OLR's testimony. At the end of the hearing, most of that testimony was simply irrelevant to the only issue that was in dispute. My lengthy decision was nevertheless issued within the timelines prescribed by this court. Have you had the opportunity to speak with Mr. Moore about his concerns?
I did not speak with him about the concerns.
Do you have any intention to do so?
I did not think it was appropriate. I felt he was expressing criticism about a case we had tried. I did not want to approach him about a case.
Well, his letter is several pages long, and that's not the only concern he's got. He's got some general ones. I just wonder if you have any intention of following up to get a trial lawyer of 41 years experience who's served as a referee, if he's got some constructive ideas that your office might benefit from.
I would tell you that I don't think it would be appropriate for me to address those concerns to him. I don't want to be seen as trying to influence the discretion of a referee. I do not agree
with... The case is over, I assume.
Case is over.
That's okay. Yeah. Well, I hope so.
And I would tell the court that I do not agree with many of the assertions in that letter. Are not correct, in my view.
Well,
with regard to
anyone who does anything
other than the case,
anyone who does anything can be criticized. It's the people who do absolutely nothing. They're the only ones who can't be criticized.
Well, but, I don't know about that.
Well, Madam Chief Justice, I'm sure it'll be in your book. I will tell you that if someone has a constructive criticism, and this certainly doesn't sound like some, I don't know this gentleman, but the letter doesn't sound like a letter authored by a crackpot. It sounds like a thoughtful letter. It sounds like a letter that raises some valid points. And quite frankly, Mr. Saleen, it reflects a certain perception among a large number of lawyers of your office.
Right, it does.
You do? Okay, you understand that. So I would say, Benjamin Franklin said, our critics are our friends, for they point out our flaws to us. And I wonder if you would have any reason beside, you don't have to talk about a specific case. He obviously has a number of experiences. I'm not trying to get you to call him, but I just wonder if I received a letter like that said, geez, there's some obvious, so in my opinion, some glaring inefficiencies that showed that members of my staff were way off the mark. And I think I would like to find out a little bit more to see if there's merit to it and to see if I could address it to change things for the better. Not so much?
I can tell you the cases that he has presided over. I can tell you that OLR did not request delays in them. I can tell you that he wrote in another one, this matter was very ably tried by two experienced attorneys in a very efficient manner. I can tell you that the case that he cites went to trial on the first day it was scheduled. And I can tell you that the information OLR presented in those 9 days was relevant. And I can tell you that it's a little bit, should be somewhat concerning that a referee would say that it was, after 9 days spent there, that it was not relevant and still did nothing to say, I want an offer of proof, I'm tired of this, let's stop, this is not helping, or are we continuing to spend the money? There are some things that I do not understand about it, but I can tell you that the general assertions as it relates to this petition are things with which OLR does not agree. And if you go back and look at the records of the cases where he's presided, the statements about giving multiple examples about OLR taking too long and delaying cases is not correct.
I think there's a bigger picture here that I'm trying to not draw for you, but point out to you. And one small step might be to call, if you don't want to talk to this gentleman, talk to someone else and get a practitioner's viewpoint. That's all I'm suggesting.
If you think it's okay for me to talk to him, I don't have any problem speaking with him. I thought it would be inappropriate because his criticism really does relate to his judgment in a case. I didn't think it was appropriate for me to
do that. As an attorney, I would think that you would, number one, I have every confidence that you in particular would be mindful of the relevant rules and any conversation that you would have would follow those rules and be in compliance with them, but also if he's got some valid observations about the general administration or the general carrying out of the functions of the office, that you might want to at least talk with him. But that's just me. So if that's not what you're interested in, there's nothing I can do to...
I certainly share the interest, and I would typically do that. I read the letter, and I sense his concern is really about the disagreement we had in the case. And I don't see anything more than that in this letter.
Well, it does seem to imply that it's part of a greater pattern. And
yes, Justice, and I did look at that pattern, and that information is not correct. Go back and look at WSCCA for his cases. You'll see that it is only this one case where he has had a concern. And the other cases were very routine. He was complimentary in the other contested case. They were all done in a very timely manner. You know, he also said that the delays are due to OLR taking too long to investigate cases. I respect the fact he doesn't know what our formal investigation processing times are, and I know that he knows we don't intentionally delay them. And I read up front in his letter that he has respect for what we do. But I have to tell you that this letter, in my view, relates to the disagreement we had in the case. And
do you view your office as primarily a prosecutor's office, or do you view your office as a vehicle to help assist attorneys in attempting to become more familiar with the rules? Now, there are all sorts of practitioners in this state,
the
majority of whom are sole practitioners. Majority of the lawyers in this state are sole practitioners. They're on their own. They're trying to scratch out a living. They're working their backsides off to try to provide. And I wonder what percentage of your office's time and resources are spent trying to reach out to people like that or to others who could benefit from your wisdom and your guidance to try to avoid these problems or to look at cases where it's a one-time deviation in an otherwise... And I have seen cases where referees have written that this was a one-time aberration in an otherwise honorable career, and have the referee observe that, you know, a phrase that stands to mind is one that my old friend from up north, one of the reserve judges, called a tempest in a teapot. And I just wonder if there's room, and you don't have to answer this.
I'm happy to respond. I want to respond.
Well, I just want you to think about the idea that maybe for some of these cases that could be fairly called a tempest in a teapot, maybe there's a little more room for the educational role of OLR and a little less room for the machinations of the state with pretty unlimited resources to prosecute them.
Thank you. I would like to respond, if I may. In the last 4 or 5 years, the number of educational programs that result from OLR grievances has doubled from about 100 to 200 per year. It's ahead of that pace this year. We look a lot at education. It's one of those other areas where everybody can win. If the lawyer is doing well, whether it's a substance problem or a medical problem or whether it's an educational problem, the diversion programs are working quite well, another thing we got from Colorado. And we have increased the use of those over years. The recidivism rates on those cases are better than public or private reprimands, and we know that. Now, it doesn't play well in the media, but we know that it works, and so it's good. We do that. I am out and about to any group that will have me. I was in Bayfield last Friday with 6 lawyers, and I went up and back and spent the night. And we talked about things that go on in sole and small practice offices, and we had a good discussion about the things that go on. Linda Albert is in the audience today. She knows that we have done a lot of work together, and we have worked together personally, looking for ways to address the concerns when lawyers are struggling, and these are typically, you know, small firm lawyers, solo practitioners, looking for ways that we can identify the concerns, get the care that they need, and help them be well, because we know that everybody wins when that happens. And so we've been very active in that. If you look at the annual reports, there's a list of things that places where I or another member of my staff have gone to talk to lawyers and to help educate and be part of that process. In addition to that, we run seminars. We have two seminars every year on trust accounting because we know it's a very technical issue. And most of the trust account violations that occur are very technical, and most of them are dismissed. And some of them are diverted, and it's really only the conversions that come to your attention. But there are a lot of them. We also run a professionalism seminar every November. The next one is next Friday at American Family. And so it's open to the public. It's also something that's used for diversion programs. It's one of the best seminars that's put on in the state if you read the reviews because of the quality of the people that we bring in to do that. So, you know, it's a concern. It's one of the few things that I can do as a human. It's one of the few things I can do as a director to do something good for somebody. You know, I go through this day in and day out, and all I do is things that tell people no, or tell them no longer.
And as a former district attorney,
yes,
and assistant district,
exactly,
attorney,
you know.
I realize the spot you're in. And I want to end, and this time I mean it, I'm going to stop now. I want to end by observing that your responses have been what I have come to expect from you, typically thoughtful and reflective of someone who is trying to be fair and trying to do a difficult task with which they are charged. And I want to let you know that I appreciate it, and I have never heard any member of the court express a differing view. But I do think that there is room for increased exchange of information, mm-hmm, so that we tend to, I think as human beings, we tend to fear and dislike those individuals and those groups who we do not necessarily know. But once we get to know them, we see that we have more in common than we have apart. That's been my, not always, but that's my experience. So I, speaking for myself only, look forward to hopefully a little better dialogue so that I don't have to eat up so much time when you come for a petition presentation.
Thank you.
Chief, I'm going to ask that we take a brief recess.
As is the custom of the justice, ask for a recess. 10 minutes, prompt, 5 after 11, we will reappear. Okay, we're in recess.
silent in commanding.
Please be seated. We are on 13-04 in the matter of the petition for amendment to rules relating to referees and the lawyer regulation system. Justice Bradley, you have something you wanted to say? Oh,
only,
Mr. Saleem,
only if I can ask
not
a
to
question.
An empty podium. Thank you.
You thought you'd never ask. I can't wait to get back up there.
Thank you. When I read the court commissioner's response, I characterized it in my mind as if the system isn't broke, why fix it sort of response. And in looking at our own Supreme Court rules, it sets out our procedure of how referees are selected. We started this morning with talking about that. Under 2108, it's the court that appoints the permanent panel of referees. Now, on occasion in the past, sometimes at the instance of the court commissioners, or if the court had a firm grasp itself of the obvious, we have not put someone on that list, or taken someone off the list, I guess is a better way to say it. And then, of course, under 2213, the clerk of the Supreme Court selects a referee from the list provided by the Supreme Court based on availability and geographic proximity to the respondent's principal office. Now, my question is this, with that by way of preference as to what our rules say. Why can't the quality and efficiency issues be satisfactorily addressed by the court culling, as is appropriate, the names from the panel, the list, and then additional education or training? Why wouldn't that take care of both quality? Training might enhance uniformity and quality, as well as efficiency.
Thank you. I think the objective here is not to try to fix something that is broken, but try to improve something that exists. That's where we are. I think that your suggestion of looking at particular individuals and doing increased training would have the same effect. I don't think we're talking about anything that's significantly different. It's a little different approach. I think under the current rule, the court could do everything that this petition asks it to do. It could. It could enter the contracts. It could limit the assignments in an appropriate way and focus them on particular individuals. I think the court could do that consistent with current rules. I think the petition does it changes the language such that then the court would be adopting a policy essentially requiring it to do so. The effectiveness of the training, I think, is certainly something we recognize. And I think that the on-the-job training is the slight distinction that we see in the approach that the petition presents. So I agree that your suggestion is good, and I think it could work with or without this petition.
May I say that the court has had training programs for referees and is now derelict in a training program, re-education or otherwise for referee, in part because we used to do it when referees would come to Madison generally. In connection with a major state bar function, and they all came, and we could do a training program and not have to pay for their travel to Madison. And I know you were all part of the training program, if I remember correctly.
respondent attorneys were part of the training program, the court commissioners were part of the training program, and others. But we have not done that for a while. And it's because one reason is because of the cost of paying for the referees to come when they're not otherwise going to be in a central place. So that may not be an excuse, but we have fallen down on that in recent years. I can't remember when the last training program was. Do you, Mr. Celine?
No, I would have to go look to see when it was.
Okay, not important, other than it hasn't been this year or last year.
That's correct.
Number two, so that we are clear on the record, the Supreme Court justices meet with, I think it's correct to say, all of the divisions, task force committees of the court, at least usually once a year, sometimes every one and a half years. OLR is the once in a year, and we meet with you. It's at lunch during a day. Everybody is here for conference, and the justices are all advised that is a meeting, and it's an open session. You prepare some things, and anyone can ask any questions they want. You're there, and all of your staff that's working that day, right?
That's correct.
Do you find them helpful?
Yes, I do. They're helpful because, as you know, we receive information about concerns that the court has with the general process,
mm-hmm.
And it results in some actions on our part, in coordination with the Board of Administrative Oversight, mm-hmm. typically, to look at some policy issues. Many of the petitions that have been filed recently are a result of those discussions, and they seem to make improvements in our system, so yes.
And I send to you some, with copies to the justices, some topics that have obviously arisen in our our discussions about particular cases or not, generally. And we do not discuss particular cases. Is that right? I just want to make that clear to everyone.
That's true.
But what is discussed is some general issues, like referees, et cetera, and issues that have come before us. As a result, not all the justices come to all the meetings, but generally most justices are at most meetings, if not all justices at some meetings. That's not only OLR, but it's with the clerk's office, with the library, with operations. I don't have to list them all, but that's it. In light of these questions, you think we should meet two or three times a year?
I think the meeting with the staff and our office one time a year is appropriate. I think there may be some value in the court or some form meeting with perhaps the director and maybe some of the deputies and litigation counsel on another basis.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be useful.
On topics that fit the appropriate.
Topics that fit the program and the policy issues, right.
Do you meet with the Chief Justice on a regular basis?
That has varied from year to year. And I would tell you, Justice Gableman.
About how often?
I typically would meet with her in recent years, once in the fall, once in the spring. And if there's an issue that arises, then I would be.
And if any other member of this court were to have a meeting with you, either at your office or someplace else, are you under any instructions or would you feel compelled in some way to report it to any other member of this court?
That question has not been presented. I would not normally feel an obligation to report a meeting or a conversation with a justice, and I don't think I've been asked or given any instruction in that regard. I would want to follow the court's instructions, however this would be done.
What was the last part?
I would want to follow the court's instructions, however it should be done.
And you haven't received such instructions.
No.
Thank you.
Now, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about
Because this has come up in a number of meetings at the court, and I just wanted, the court has had differing opinions about this, and that's the discussion about your discretion. So as I see it, your first item of discretion is, there are many items, but
sure,
whether you're going to drop it before you even go to the PRC.
Yes, that's true.
Whether wherever it comes in, you get a complaint, you get a grievance, you look at it, study it, you decide, hey, maybe there is a little problem here, but it's not worth going further. Do you have that discretion?
I do not believe the rule provides me that discretion.
So you have to go to the PRC.
I would have to do something other than dismiss it if the evidence, in our view, was sufficient to prove any violation.
Okay. So you would go to diversion, you'd get a consent or something, but if you found a violation, no matter how tiny, you have to go to the PRC.
The rules do not allow me to dismiss something where there is, do you believe there is cause to proceed. Now, I do need to tell you that in cases of minor trust account violations, I frequently will dismiss minor technical violations and provide some advice to the lawyer because although it is a violation of the rule, it does not merit discipline. I do not, the text of the Supreme Court rules does not tell me I can do that, but I believe it is so minor that it would be inappropriate to proceed. And those are situations where it is clear that the lawyer understands and we expect that compliance will follow without any further action.
So I'm not sure I understand your answer.
There's an exception for a trust account.
Okay, but that's the only exception. Okay.
Yes.
Otherwise, so you go to the PRC, and if they say proceed, you go. No discretion.
The rule does not provide me for discretion. There have been cases where I have exercised discretion not to proceed. And that would occur in the circumstance where information we receive after the PRC's cause to proceed finding convinces us that we no longer have a reasonable basis to proceed. And it might be by count in a case, or it might be to dismiss a case against an attorney in toto, or not to file it, but to dismiss it.
You asked whether you wanted, you thought it would be a good idea to plea bargain. You thought giving you that authority was a good idea.
It would be helpful, I think, to handle cases, more cases than we can handle right now, because I believe the discretion is limited. I think it must be subject to review outside of our office, depending upon the circumstance, perhaps by a different reviewer. I think it would improve the timeliness of the process somewhat, yes.
Do you think it would be helpful to give you the usual prosecutorial discretion that if it's minor, that you have authority not to proceed? Like the authority you're using in trust accounts.
I don't think anyone in their own self-interest would decline to accept full discretion to do whatever they pleased. But when I think about the system, I think that there will be a public perception that may be adverse if you vest all that discretion in the director without review. And grievance in particular are going to be concerned about this, and I think it would reflect adversely on their perception of the fairness and the quality of this process and this system.
What about taking it to the PRC and saying, hey, I've got enough for clear and convincing on this, but it's a minor, it's technical, it really doesn't merit discipline, even if you found a violation?
I think that would be an option for certain cases. I haven't thought about this fully, but what I would foresee is, as it's presented to me today, I would foresee that in the case of a consent reprimand agreement, that it would be reviewed, any plea bargain that's part of it would be reviewed by the referee reviewing the reprimand, which seemed to make sense to me. If it's part of a case that's filed with the court, then, of course, I think the referee and then that recommendation then subsequently reviewed by the court. In the case of a diversion, it's more difficult. to do. There's not really a mechanism right now for reviewing that, and the PRC might be the appropriate place to do that. Some of these would be plea bargains that result in dismissals. And so that might be something else that would necessarily, or what might be appropriately, rather, reviewed by the PRC.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then once the referee makes a decision, then you have discretion whether to appeal or not.
As provided as in the rule, either party can appeal. Yes.
All right. So you view it as having very limited discretion at the very beginning.
With regard, yes. But, of course, the appellate discretion is much greater. Yes.
Is different. Okay. That's good. You've heard a lot of discussion here about criticism of the OLR. And, of course, any prosecutor is criticized, especially by the persons who are respondents, right? No one wants to be subject to the prosecutor.
I understand.
Right.
I would not.
Right. So, what do you think is a good technique to have open, transparent discussion of ways to improve the system? Now, this is one, and we're focusing on referees, right?
Right.
But that's why I propose to you, Mr. Salini, that we consider asking some of your peers from other states to come in. We present them with some questions. You present them with questions and have a review and an open discussion, which is what we did 13 years ago, and focus it on what we think are the major issues, whether it's discretion, whether it's delay or long time before filing a complaint, wherever we find it, in order to make the OLR proceeding, and I include from that everything, including up through the court, more transparent and understood and improved where need be. So, Mr. Rogan appointed a committee in 2011. They came back with recommendations, and we have two of those recommendations before us. So, are more recommendations needed, or are more reviews needed?
Chief, I would tell you that in my mind, it's always good to have somebody else outside look at what you're doing and help you do better. And it would seem to be an appropriate thing to do periodically. And, you know, it's been 13 years. It's been 15 since the study, but
right.
13 years under the system, of course. And I would think that after 10 years or 11 years, it's an appropriate time to have an outside review, no matter what is going on in the system. So I think that may be helpful. It certainly would not be unhelpful. And it would be the kind of thing that OLR would welcome.
And would you be able to suggest some peers?
Absolutely.
Recognized in the field?
Yes. Yes, I would. I know some people off the top of my head. There might be some others I would want to go back. As you may know, Bill Weigel in our office was the president of our national organization. He's very...
Who is that?
Bill Weigel.
Mm-hmm.
So we already do this to some extent, you know, through our national connections. And so I would probably want to talk with Bill about some good selections before I provided the court a list of individuals. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple who I know just off the top of my head.
And if you have a suggestion how we can do something with referees in terms of further education, that would be good. I know that we attempted to serve, do a listserv, and I'm talking about not necessarily the nuts and bolts of the educational program, but how to set it up so that we reduce the costs of that. And maybe by the Internet, to becoming more adept at educational programs through the Internet. That would may just reduce costs. Are there any other issues to come before the court? And then I would like you, Mr. Saleen, I haven't set up any meetings with your office yet this year, but we should do that in light of the conversation. And so let us talk about and send out a potential agenda for the meeting, including the entire staff, and another meeting, including just the, for lack of a better phrase, the leadership or the substantive, if you prefer, and what might be included in that agenda. Now, we've been meeting at lunch, usually lasts from about 12 to 1:30, 1:45 on a conference day, rather than, I don't have too many conference days, so that's another issue, so I would prefer to leave it on a conference day with the lunch hour. So why don't we do that, okay?
Yes, Chief, I will.
Fair enough?
Yes.
All right. Any other questions? Justice Brasso.
Mr. Saleen, did you have an opportunity to see the communication from former referee Tim Boelke?
I did, Justice Brasso.
Okay. He says on the first page of that communication, I handled stipulated private and public reprimands, but neither charged nor for them nor kept track of them. But I estimate that I would receive as many as six in a year. Is his practice, or was his practice of not charging for that uncommon?
I don't know. When I read that, I did not know before I read that that he was not charging for that. And I don't know if other referees do the same thing or not.
Okay. He also said, and I quote, "Frankly, I saw time spent as a referee essentially as pro bono service to the bar and Supreme Court of Wisconsin, as it did not cover expenses of running a law office." Is that an uncommon attitude among the enumerated referees that we've had?
I think many referees would look at what they do as a public service. I think they are pleased that they are able to do that. I think that they are they're grateful for that opportunity. It gives them a way to give back to the community and to the profession, and that's part of what's underlying our present system.
Is that attitude consistent with the proposal?
I think it is consistent with the proposal. The auxiliary referees will still remain and do some work. There do not need to be four right now, or ever, and maybe someday we would decide that four is not enough. We certainly have to manage the hours such that it remains economical and does not result in increased cost, as Justice Rogensack was careful to make clear to me today, and which I understand, and I agree with her. So we would have to manage that, but it could be one, could be two at this point, and such that the auxiliary referees will remain.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you, Mr. Saleen. Ordinarily, and you will be given that opportunity that the presenter can, if he wishes, summarize and comment after the other appearances are made.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Saleen. I have here Dean Dietrich, Attorney Dietrich of Warsaw, to Attorney Diedrich, you've been kind enough to submit letters to.
Thank you, Chief Justice, members of the court. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today. I appear here today as a practitioner in the what I call professional responsibility world. I'm not appearing on behalf of any committee of the State Bar of Wisconsin. I'm a member of the law firm of Ruta Ware in Wausau, but I appear only as a practitioner working in this particular field. I have submitted a written report to you, and I'd like to comment on that briefly, and then I would like to, if you will allow, to comment on some of the discussion that has taken place thus far. The concern that I expressed in my letter is the concern regarding the right to strike a referee. As a practitioner representing respondents in these proceedings, the selection of the referee is a critical consideration that is undertaken, is looked at, is considered as the process begins. It is often very much a struggle because the process begins very quickly once a referee is appointed by the court. And my concern, and when I first saw this proposal and looked at it and tried to address it, is if the Office of Lawyer Regulation is going to be the principal party on the other side of all of these cases, and you're now limiting the number of people that will hear the cases, should they have that right to an automatic strike as compared to the respondent having the right to an automatic strike? You can argue both sides of that, but the concern that I express and the reason why I wish to appear before you is because if you're now going to limit the number of people that would be assigned to hear the case, and I'll speak to perhaps a comment about that number in a minute, then I think there should be some consideration that the prosecutor in that case, while they did not select the referee, the prosecutor, because by the nature of the process, they're always the one going before these four referees, should not be in the same boat to be striking someone. It may be someone that the respondent thinks is a good person. If the automatic right to a strike is given the other side, then that limits the ability of the respondent to make some assessment about the other candidates. And I do want to reassure you that the assessment of who is going to be the referee in the case is a very significant decision that is discussed at length with the respondent before a decision is made. It's partially an analysis of, well, if this person is stricken, who else is going to be out there? And that's as much a consideration. So that is the purpose and the reason for my suggestion that the revision be taken to the strike rule.
Mr. Dietrich, one yes. thing I didn't see in your letter, but is, I think, underlines your argument, or is at least in the background, is the logical extension of your argument, which is, given the fact that it would be the office, the OLR, that routinely appears in front of the referees, and the respondent typically does not, the OLR could effectively run one of the referees out of business.
From the perspective of exercising a strike every time, that is true. And there is, you know, there's not a so-called mechanism to address that, although I suspect that the court would be viewing that and seeing that and might have an opportunity to comment about that. I mean, there may be legitimate reasons for some of the strikes.
As proposed, the effect of a consistent exercise of a discretionary right to substitution applied to one referee could run that referee out of business.
Right. Yeah. That's true. A concern, of course, on my part as a respondent counsel is my appearing before a number of the different referees and having made some opinions myself as to the suitability of that referee, which is a part of that.
What's your criteria for suitability of referee?
Pardon me?
What's your criteria for suitability of referee?
Is that a trade secret?
There is some element of a trade secret, but I will highlight.
Take out those elements.
But I will highlight to the court a very strong consideration, which we often don't think about in these proceedings, is, and you have talked for a great deal of time about judges, former sitting judges, things like that. You know, there are cases that are prosecuted by the Office of Lawyer Regulation that, frankly, relate solely to the practice of law. May involve conflicts of interest, may involve, frankly, law firm dissolutions, may involve communication with clients. Interestingly, I'm not that excited about a former judge hearing that case, because there is a practical, real-world side to these cases that I may want a practitioner who has been in a law practice and is still in a law practice. So there are a lot of considerations that go into that. And, yes, as you spend more time in this particular practice, you gain opinions and apply criteria, yes.
And they don't necessarily involve litigation. They may involve in-office practice. Now, I understand why they want a litigation background, because they're thinking of running the referee hearing, and that's why they want that. But your criteria goes to, is there a one, what does the code mean? Right. Two, is there a violation, right?
Right.
When you consider how the law is practiced and what the balances are made
right. In
order to practice law in that particular field.
That is correct, Your Honor. And, in fact, if I may, this comment was made to Attorney Saleen about a year ago, and he kind of laughed at me, although, unfortunately, I think he would probably agree. I don't consider myself a trial lawyer. So, frankly, I wonder if I would qualify under that criteria to be a referee. And if I may take that to the discussions that this court has had about dealing with a small pool of referees, and I use those words because maybe four isn't the number, maybe six is the number, maybe eight is the number. I have practiced in the area of labor relations for 37 years. And while you may think that there are a large host of labor arbitrators in the state of Wisconsin and labor arbitrators in this country, the reality is there's a small pool of labor arbitrators that both sides would rather try a case before than to open it up to looking at a panel of five labor arbitrators on the American Arbitration Association panel and have to strike one of those people down to the one arbitrator. You have asked whether there really would be efficiencies if we had a more limited pool of referees. Trying a case before an experienced labor arbitrator with experienced counsel on both sides of that labor arbitration case probably, and this, of course, is not subject to some study on my part, but probably you increase efficiency by 40%. And I picked that number because the labor arbitrator is familiar with the issues that arise in the form of a labor arbitration case, interpreting the language, when you're dealing with an issue of seniority and how do you determine seniority and how should seniority apply in a layoff setting. A labor arbitrator with some experience has been through those debates, those discussions, and is very much able to crystallize the issues and to address the issues very efficiently. In my humble opinion, the uniqueness and the very, very specific and difficult interpretations under the rules of professional conduct are more unique, are more difficult, are more requiring of some experience and understanding than even labor principles. And I've had the opportunity over the years to represent judges who are considered employers in certain settings and how they interpret the labor principles that may exist in a labor agreement. And I will tell you that it is a very interesting conversation in the closed doors of the chambers when I'm trying to explain labor law principles to a judge. So I offer to you what I think is my opinion, having lived in this world of labor arbitration, that there will be efficiencies. Now, sometimes those efficiencies will be in favor of the prosecutor, and sometimes those efficiencies will be in favor of the respondent. But this particular area of the law, as I often counsel my clients about, has very much its own language and has very much its own interpretation under the rules. And someone who has read the conflict of interest rule over and over and over again is able to get to the gravamen of a dispute much quicker than someone who has to be educated by the practitioners, the counsel before them, as to what the dispute is and how that dispute applies. Now, that doesn't mean that that can't happen, and there is a wealth of experienced people on your current list. But if I were to try and quantify, and I could not, other than to tell you that in my experience, the labor arbitration cases are much more efficiently handled when you're dealing with an experienced arbitrator.
Okay, now I have a question for you. Is it your position, then, that you would favor a smaller panel than the 32, smaller, less than 10. I'm just picking a
right.
number because I
right.
don't think the particular number is the important thing.
Right. I am in favor of a smaller pool. I understand there are significant issues about doing the hearing in a geographical area. There are issues about the availability. There's issues about timing. I understand all of those issues. I think, you know, my practice travels all over the state. I think that's just the way things are today, and I think it is a little different than what it used to be as far as transparency and as far as transient practices.
Okay, so you favor a smaller pool. I hear you, it doesn't mean I've heard you correctly, that the pool for referees you would not list as the top and maybe only criteria, that they have litigation experience or trial experience, whichever you think is a better word, above that perhaps the top one would be that they have experience, repeated experience, in dealing with the code and in dealing with practice.
Yes.
You would obviously want to put in experience and output of the phrase how to conduct an efficient proceeding.
It would certainly be something that I would consider when looking at a referee.
Right.
But whether or not something is going to be admitted into the record as hearsay or not is not as important to me as an understanding that the conflict rules only arise in these set of circumstances.
In an understanding of the code, how it developed, what the other ABA states are doing and translating it, blah, blah, blah.
To some level, in fairness, I would not expect a referee, for example, to remain proficient in what are the ABA model rule changes, like some of us would want to do.
That's right, because that's the point of counsel. But there's a background and an understanding generally of this area, which is a very special area of the law. That's what I hear you say.
That is correct, Chief
okay.
Justice.
So that gets you to the A pool of, I just picked the number 10, and that if you had a pool of 10, I'm trying to get away from 4, that... how would you feel about giving the OLR the right to strike then?
Part of me recognizing that the discussions that we are having today are ultimately focused around, you know, doing the right thing for the law and the bar and practice.
Not your potential clients, because you might represent OLR sometime.
If there's a larger pool, I am less troubled by the notion that OLR would have an automatic strike like the respondent.
That's what I assumed your answer would be, which is why I took it to 10. You are also, if I may move from this, you're also on or have been on the State Bar Committee. I will use the term oversight for OLR and the OLR system, right?
Well, I currently serve on the Committee on Professional Ethics that has been assigned that task, although I would not say that that has been a focus of my past service.
I understand, but the State Bar does have a committee that does, in fact, one of the petitioners, aren't they? The State Bar is, anyway.
Right. I'd like to first respond as a respondent attorney, and then I would like to respond personally. As a respondent attorney, the procedures of the Office of Lawyer Regulation and the discipline process has been overly criticized simply because any lawyer who is subject to an investigation, quite frankly, is concerned about all sorts of potential impacts, and I will tell you that whenever I am contacted by an attorney about an investigation, I'm concerned about suicide. That's a consideration that I have in discussing with a lawyer. Right. So respondents, as a respondent counsel, I think there's a lot of concern that this is a heavy-weighted process and it should be reviewed and certain things like that. As a practitioner and answering for what I think is the best interests of the profession, I do believe that the system is in relatively good shape. I think there should be some good faith, I think there should be some legitimate discussion about more authority being vested in the Office of Lawyer Regulation for plea bargaining at different stages. That particular process, I think, would help expedite things. I think it is different when the attorney that's being investigated has counsel to explain some of the things to them versus OLR trying to negotiate some sort of a compromise with the attorney being investigated, him or herself. It becomes very difficult, I would think, in that process to be successful. Right. That helps to the amount of time I spend explaining the process and the thing is, I think, helpful to the lawyer being investigated understanding the process. I do think certainly it's in the best interest of the profession to have this thing, the whole process reviewed again. Unfortunately, I think attorneys who have been investigated have a very negative opinion. There's certainly media that has a very different opinion, both of which I don't think are accurate. Yes. And I would hope that there could be education of those two sides to why some of their opinions or perceptions are not accurate. May I answer it both ways? If I could, as a respondent's counsel, if I could change one thing in the system, it would be some way to have more participation by respondent's counsel at the time the preliminary review committee considers the facts and makes a decision to proceed. Am I convinced that that would change their decisions? I'm not convinced of that. But it appears to be a one-sided process at that stage. As a respondent's counsel, I have the right to submit things. Those things are presented. I believe the preliminary review committee reviews those documents. But the counsel being investigated believes that's a one-sided process. I think the number as quoted was 98%. I've not heard that number before, and I still believe that it is a reasonably good process. As a member of the bar and wanting to improve it for the betterment of the profession, it would be more ability to negotiate even after the preliminary review committee has made its decision. Because in I'm guessing 30% of the cases, once the preliminary review committee makes its decision to proceed with charges, then that lawyer will retain counsel. And counsel then has the opportunity to look at a number of things and perhaps talk a little closer to the language that the Office of Lawyer Regulation is more comfortable with to show why things should not go forward. I don't believe so. Let me give you my microphone. I don't think I need it. Yes, I will adjust my schedule and be back at 1:30. Mm-hmm.